Memphis. Every Thursday morning from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Time, we broadcast live from Crosstown Concourse in Memphis on 91.7 FM. And we have the opportunity to talk with guests about the role of faith in their lives and the meaningful work that they are doing in the community context. We always start the show with the saint of the day. And this weekend is the feast day of Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard was actually the son of a knight and a landowner near Dijon, France, born in the year 1090. He received a secular education, but in the year 1113, decided to enter a monastery. As you might imagine, his family was not pleased with his choice of pursuing the monastic vocation, but he was able to persuade four of his brothers and 26 friends to join him as monks. And after only 3 years, he'd been so successful in witnessing and evangelizing and encouraging men to consider the monastic life that he was given the permission to establish his own monastery in the year 1115. His monastery had some pretty rigorous rules in terms of the sorts of ways in which they ordered their lives. And in fact, he denied himself sleep to the detriment of his own physical health so that he might have time to write letters and sermons and continue to encourage Christians to deepen their relationship with God. And his preaching was so effective that eventually 60 new abbeys were founded just based upon his sermons and his ministry. By the year 1140, his writings had made him one of the most influential preachers in the area. And all sorts of people sought him out for guidance and spiritual direction, from bishops to princes. And so he found himself involved not only with determining issues related to the church, but also to serve almost as a mediator in terms of settling disputes among secular rulers. And so because of his willingness to be involved in the issues that touched people's daily lives, he found himself moving in circles way beyond what we might consider to be the cloistered life of a monk in a monastery. We have lots of his writings that are still in existence. And he was also a writer of many hymns of the church, one of which is very familiar and beloved in the Episcopal tradition, which is, "O Sacred Head, Sore Wounded." So we will end this segment with the prayer that we use as we reflect on the powerful ministry of Bernard of Clairvaux. O God, by whose grace your servant Bernard of Clairvaux, kindled with the flame of your love, became a burning and shining light in your church, grant that we also may be aflame with the spirit of love and discipline, and walk before you as children of light, through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. What a beautiful hymn of the church. And we give thanks for Bernard of Clairvaux, who actually wrote the words to that hymn. So today, we're really pleased to have with us in the studio the executive director of the Community Legal Center. And Diana is an attorney, and I think we share some things in common, and hopefully I'll get a chance to learn a little bit more about what brought her to her legal career. She got her bachelor's degree from Rhodes College and her law degree from the University of Memphis, and following graduation from law school, she clerked for both the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Tennessee and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, then joined the Memphis office of Butler and Snow, where she was an associate and then a partner, practicing primarily in the areas of commercial and appellate litigation. And she joined the Community Legal Center in 2021. So Diana, welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Thank you so much, Bishop Phoebe. Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
So I understand that the mission of the organization is to provide civil legal services to those who are limited, those with limited means and who are at risk. And, you know, serving the least among us is a central tenet of all of the Abrahamic traditions, both Christianity as well as Judaism and Islam. So I wonder, to start off with, when you were growing up, was there a faith tradition that was a part of your life?
There was. Faith has always been a part of my life. My parents instilled in me the values of compassion and service to others. I grew up going to church. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to be exposed to other faith traditions outside of the church that I was born into. And when I left home, I grew up in Southwest Florida. Mm-hmm. I left home when I was 18 to move to Memphis and attend Rhodes College, which is historically affiliated with a Presbyterian mm-hmm. church. And one of the things that attracted me to Rhodes was its strong history and commitment to service to the community. I wanted not only a strong academic tradition, but an opportunity to become more involved and more enmeshed in the community in which I lived. Mm-hmm. So I moved to Memphis, and I have been here ever since. I loved my going to Rhodes, and I stayed here for law school. And that dedication to serving others and to having my life be about something bigger than myself alone and giving back to my community has mm-hmm. always been a part of my life.
Yeah, wow. So now some people know that they want to pursue a career in law from an early age. I was not one of those persons, but I wonder, did you always know that you wanted to be a lawyer?
Well, if you ask my mother, she would probably say that I had, you know, good arguments as a young child and was probably destined to do something similar to this. But for me, it was a while coming to it.
Yeah.
When I was at Rhodes, one of the things that I was involved with was the Rhodes College Women's Center, mm-hmm. which was a center for advocacy and support for folks who had survived sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed being a part of that mm-hmm. organization and helping people get the resources and care that they needed. So somewhere in my, you know, middle years mm-hmm. in college, I started thinking, well, maybe I might like to do some sort of advocacy work for a career. And I was also an English major, so whatever I did for a career was always going to involve words and reason mm-hmm. and argumentation in some way. But that started to pique my interest in going to law school. And that led me to the University of Memphis here in town, where I had the opportunity to intern with several organizations serving our lower income neighbors here mm-hmm. in Memphis, including Memphis Area Legal Services and the Community Legal Center, mm-hmm. where I now have a full-time
wow.
gig.
Yeah. So when I was in private practice, I did have the opportunity to do, you know, some pro bono cases, but really, when you're dealing with billable hours, there wasn't a whole lot of time to do the sort of stuff that really fed me. How did you balance sort of the practice of law at a large firm, first as an associate and then as a partner? Were you able to continue your affiliation with some of these other sorts of organizations that seemed to have really fed you?
You're right. It's tough mm-hmm. when you're at a large law firm. You are being challenged in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. There are many demands on your time. You're working on large, complex cases. There are always other things that you could be doing. You could be writing articles. You could be speaking. And I think for me, I had to really sometimes take a step back and remember what it was that really fed my passion in law school and helped give another layer of meaning to mm-hmm. my work. I enjoyed doing the work when I was at my law firm. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed working on difficult cases mm-hmm. and helping clients untangle knotty legal problems. But you're right. There is always, when you have that bug for service, mm-hmm. you need to feed it in some way. In my early years at the law firm, I fed that with... At the time, I was so busy that I was not able to take on individual cases.
Right, right.
But I did go to legal clinics that were held in the community. So the Memphis Area Legal Services mm-hmm. at the time had Saturday legal clinics here at the Ben Hooks Library in town mm-hmm. where you would go, attorneys would go and meet one-on-one with clients. And give them brief advice and counsel. Maybe not sign up for full representation,
right.
but help guide them. This is the way you need to go, or this is what you can expect, or a good first step for you would be to do X.
Mm-hmm.
And as time went on, and I had a little bit more seniority at the firm, and after I made partner, mm-hmm. I was able to take on more cases pro bono. So in my latter years at the firm, I did a fair amount of pro bono work in the probate area, so helping mm-hmm. folks with their wills and estates, powers of attorney, healthcare powers of attorney, helping folks get conservatorships over family members who could no longer make their own medical or financial mm-hmm. decisions or just were not capable of doing that, or helping folks or stepping in as a court-appointed guardian ad litem to make a report to the court in cases of these conservatorships. So I really enjoyed that work, and it turned out it was great preparation for coming to the Community Legal Center because that's a good chunk of what we do.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great segue. So I think that the organization, I believe, is in its 28th year. So for the listening audience who may not be familiar with the Community Legal Center, can you let us know a little bit about the history, why it was founded, and sort of the needs that you all are trying to meet?
Sure, absolutely. We have been around, as you said, for 28 years. We were founded in 1994, kind of as a joint project between Memphis Area Legal Services, private attorneys who recognized a need in the community, and the Association for Women Attorneys. And
mm-hmm.
the original idea behind what became the Community Legal Center was to create a mediation center for lower income folks at Memphis Area Legal Services who wanted help mediating their divorces.
Mm-hmm.
And so the organization was originally chartered as the AWA Family Mediation Center. Well, it wasn't too long into the organization's history when people realized that the need was greater than just
a divorce and mediation.
Just a divorce and just mediation,
yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So the name was changed to the Community Legal Center. And over time, the mission of the Community Legal Center and the way we operate has changed incrementally. We have gone from offering mediations for divorces to really offering a wide variety of civil legal aid as well as immigration legal aid for lower income folks.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks that we serve primarily are folks that make a little bit too much money to qualify for free legal aid through Memphis Area Legal Services, but it's not enough to really realistically be able to go out and hire a private attorney
right.
on their own. So we step in and offer low sliding scale fees to help those folks with their civil problems. so that they can resolve those problems in a way that doesn't break the bank,
mm-hmm.
and they can move on with their lives. And we've also morphed from an agency that originally placed cases with pro bono attorneys,
mm-hmm.
To really an in-house law firm in our own right.
Got it.
Right now, we're about to have 7 attorneys,
mm-hmm.
As well as a staff, including several paralegals and Department of Justice accredited representatives. So really, we take on a lot of our cases in-house, and the client benefits from us functioning as a nonprofit mm-hmm. law firm, being able to share resources, bounce ideas off of each other, and just be able to benefit from the efficiencies of scale that comes from being a law firm in your own right.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine that there probably were things that you learned as a partner at your former law firm, even though it's a much smaller scale, that are directly applicable to your management of your current organization.
When I was, one of the benefits about being a young associate at a large law firm is that you get to do a little bit of everything. When I first started at my firm, I had the privilege of being able to do work in lots of different areas. Everything from contract disputes to employment disputes to, big pharmaceutical mm-hmm. litigation and really insurance disputes, and you take a little bit from each of those cases and you kind of learn how to issue spot,
mm-hmm.
what things to be aware of. By the time I was a partner, I was concentrating my practice on commercial and appellate litigation. But certainly all of those years of working on employment mm-hmm. law cases, I think, has given me an appreciation and an exposure of those kind of human resources issues that you have to be aware of when, you're running a business.
Yep.
Making budgets for clients at the outset of cases has helped me a lot in setting a budget
mm-hmm.
and sticking to a budget for a small business like ours. So, it's not all completely transferable,
right.
But a lot of what I did learn at my law firm mm-hmm. has really helped in my transition to leadership at the Community Legal Center.
That's great. So according to your website, there are a couple of different major program areas that you're involved in. There's a civil program. There's a pro se parents clinic, which deals with getting visitation rights and uncontested divorces. You provide a variety of services with your immigrant justice program and the elder law program to really work with some of our most vulnerable members of the community who are senior citizens, as well as the civil immigrant justice program. And I wonder, Diana, are there any sort of themes or consistent things that you see people getting themselves into a situation where they would need a lawyer just because they weren't aware of certain things? Have you sort of come across certain patterns of types of representation that you have to help people with, whereas if there had been some education up front, maybe they wouldn't have ended up in that position?
Certainly. And I think as you were asking the question, two of our programs in particular popped into mind, our civil law program mm-hmm. and our elder law program. In the elder law context, when someone passes away, if they pass away without a will,
right.
Whatever they had desired to happen mm-hmm. to their property before they passed away, if it's not written down, committed to writing, and signed in the way that a proper mm-hmm. will should be, then your assets, the things that you own, are going to be divided by the laws of the state of Tennessee. And very often those things are not exactly what you would have wished.
Right.
We see that often with homes, for example.
Right.
Someone lives in a home and they desire it to go to a certain relative, perhaps, who's been living with them and helping them, but they never commit it to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And when they pass, the state of Tennessee says, well, because you didn't leave a will,
mm-hmm.
Your home is going to go to these people.
Right.
Whereas if there had been some education beforehand mm-hmm. about, you can actually set up an entire plan for how you'd like all of your things to be distributed when you pass. It's not something that any of us likes to think about when we pass. But planning for the future can really help avert family arguments, strife in the family. It could help prevent your assets from being tied up in the court for a long time. And if you are a parent of a minor child, you can even use your estate plan to set up guardianships for those minor children, so that if you predecease your children, your wishes are embodied in that estate plan. So that is an area where our attorneys work hard to educate folks in the community about how to protect themselves, give a little forethought to what they'd like to do, have conversations with your family members and say, I'd like to name you. If I'm incapable of making my own financial or healthcare decisions, I would like to designate you as my trusted person, my power of attorney to make those decisions for me. Would you be willing to serve in that capacity? And having that conversation about how would you like to be treated if, for example, you were incapacitated, and making clear what your wishes are with that person. Having all of that written down, committed to writing, can really be a comfort to the family, because this is what mom wanted, for example. And in our civil program, we often see that there are sometimes issues with folks who are caught in sort of rent-to-own type contracts that are difficult to get out of, and have very punitive provisions for missing a payment. And they're often difficult to deal with after the fact, after the contract has been signed and you've entered into it. But our attorneys can help look at it before you sign it and help you understand what it is that you're signing and what the ramifications are, what you're signing up for. So those are just a couple of areas where some pre-planning, coming to see our attorneys and getting some legal advice on the front end, or attending a community education event, can help avert some legal issues down the line.
Yeah. It's interesting that pre-planning is not only helpful from a legal standpoint, it's also helpful from a faith perspective standpoint. And I find that when someone dies, and if they had certain ideas about the service, who they would like to speak or to read, hymn selections, if they have already planned it out and just on a piece of paper written down, the names of the people they would want to read the lessons, the particular passages of scripture that are meaningful to them that they want read during the funeral, as well as the hymns, it makes it so much easier when a family's dealing with so much other stuff. There's so many decisions to make. If they can open the file and see all of that, number one, it reduces the stress, and then it ensures that the person's wishes are carried out. But I do find that when you don't have that documentation, oftentimes the remaining family members will be in conflict about what they want to do in the funeral. And it can be a time of great tension.
Right.
But again, I guess it's difficult for many of us to reflect on our own mortality. But thinking about that and knowing that all of us are going to die, to really get not only our legal house in shape, but also if we are a person of faith, what we want to happen in terms of our homegoing service, that's really helpful.
It is. You can make a plan, and you can include in that plan whatever you want. You can include information about, do you have, some sort of burial insurance?
Right.
Would you like to be cremated?
Right.
It's especially if you think that you might have multiple grown children who might disagree about what to do if you haven't made your wishes clear in advance. It can be a great source of comfort for those family members to know, all right, my dad put all of this down on paper before he passed, so I can be confident that I am doing what he would have wanted. And it is such a hard and stressful time when a family member passes away, that being able to follow this plan can ease some of that pain.
Yeah. So one of the areas you're involved in is, of course, the area of assisting immigrants. And we know that there have been lots of things in the news about not only the situation in Ukraine, but also immigrants from other parts of the world being resettled right here in Memphis. What does your work in that area look like? And can you give us a sense of some of the countries that the immigrants come from that you all have assisted?
Over the years, the Community Legal Center has assisted immigrants from about 50 different countries. With their legal needs, and we work work in the areas of family and humanitarian-based legal aid. So we can help folks with U visas. So those are visas for persons who have been victims of crime and who have assisted in the investigation and prosecution of their cases. We can assist people with T visas, visas for victims of human trafficking. We can assist people with applying for asylum. And that is a good portion of the work that we are doing now with Afghan refugees who came to Memphis and Shelby County last year. We can help people with bringing over their relatives from overseas. And we can help people who are eligible to renew their DACA status, among other things. So you mentioned, you know, the current crises that are happening in our world in the Ukraine and in Afghanistan, and we are working with both of those populations. It was about a year ago that the Taliban took over Afghanistan, and we saw so many of those heartbreaking images in the news of Afghans fleeing their country, and several of them, several of those families made their way to Shelby County. And the Community Legal Center has been working in a coalition with two other immigration nonprofit law firms here in town, Advocates for Immigrant Rights and Mid-South Immigration Advocates. Together, we make up a coalition called Welcome South. And we are working together to provide free legal services to those, to the Afghans who settled here in Shelby County. There are a number of resettlement organizations that were involved in bringing those folks over and getting them resettled in our community and helping them integrate into our community. But these folks need legal services in order to be able to stay here and not have to fear being sent back to Afghanistan.
Right.
So thanks to some support from some of our local churches here in Memphis, as well as generous support from the Shelby County Commission, our group is able to aid those Afghans without charging them.
Well, that's great.
And as the war in Ukraine has sadly gone on, we have gotten more and more calls for help involving those families, and have started to assist some of them as well.
So I imagine you've been with Community Legal Center since 2021. So, right, you came in the midst of the pandemic. And I would imagine that you all have had to modify your work. How has trying to provide legal services, meeting with clients, you know, filing petitions or even showing up for court proceedings, how has COVID impacted the way in which you all are doing business?
You know, I think just like with any law firm, we had to change so quickly. The way that we traditionally did business really had to change almost overnight. It was no longer safe for us to go about business as usual, which for a lawyer here in Shelby County often means, you know, going down to a packed courtroom on Friday morning for the Friday morning motion docket and addressing the judge in person and just, you know, being in a room with all of your fellow attorneys. That couldn't happen during COVID. Like so many industries, we made the pivot to Zoom and to telephonic consultations. And, you know, now that we are more than 2 years out from the onset of the pandemic, we are starting to do more in-person events where it is, you know, safe to do so. But I think that some of the things that we have adapted during the pandemic will be with us for a long time. We have learned that we can do our work consulting with clients over the phone. And in fact, that might be a more expeditious way to work, because our clients don't have to take off work and drive to see us in the middle of the day. We can
do it during their lunch break, whatever time that is. Yeah,
exactly. We can have an initial consultation over the phone, and we can simply see more clients. We can serve more clients in that way. I think the courts have changed for good. I think that Zoom hearings, you know, at least for matters where the judges don't need to see a witness,
right,
physically observe them, I think those are here to stay. And again, they can really assist in the efficiency of the work of the court. You know, there is something a little bit that is lost about it, though. One of the ways that a young attorney is trained is simply by going to court. A young litigator, I should say, is by going to court, going with a more seasoned attorney, observing what is happening in the courtroom, learning lessons from seeing the judge on the bench, seeing what happens in the courtroom, and seeing how best to make an argument in front of a particular judge. I think that you can still get some of that over Zoom, but I think that something a little bit is lost when you are not able to be there in person with your fellow attorneys and the judge. So, you know, that's something that we'll need to be mindful of as we're going forward in the new generation of law students is graduating from law school.
Yep.
Now, I think that they will be the most technologically adept generation of law students ever to come out of law school.
Yeah.
But we will just need to make a conscious effort to make sure that they are getting the in-person training that they need.
Yeah. So in the time that you have been working with the Community Legal Center, has the nature of this work impacted your own personal faith? You know, have you had different sorts of prayers or thought about some of these issues from a different lens based upon your own faith tradition?
I've certainly seen how overwhelming the need is in Memphis.
Yeah.
You know, last year we got 5,600 calls for help, and we were able to help just under about 2,000 of those folks.
So less than half.
Less than half.
Wow.
And I think that it has really sharpened my understanding of how much need there is in Memphis, and how much need there is for an organization like ours, who is that is working with people who kind of fall into a gap. Where they need affordable representation and help to access the courts. And I think that it's helped me think more creatively about how can we help these people realize the promise of equal justice under the law. You know, when we say the Pledge of Allegiance, we say liberty and justice for all.
For all, yeah.
And you know, I think that not everyone thinks about the fact that justice may not be equally accessible to everyone simply depending on how much money you make. In this country, if you are accused of a crime and you cannot afford a lawyer, one can be appointed for you. There's no such right to counsel in a civil legal case. Folks are kind of left to either try to represent themselves in court or scrape up the money and try to hire a private attorney, which could quickly drain their savings. And that is where an organization that can think flexibly and creatively, like the Community Legal Center, comes in to broaden access for the most people possible. And so some of the innovations that our law firm has worked on is helping people represent themselves more effectively in court. You mentioned our work with pro se parents. That is a program that we have that helps parents learn how to represent themselves in court in cases involving their minor children. So it might be filing a petition for visitation in the Shelby County Juvenile Court if the parents are unmarried but share a child, or if the parents need to get a divorce, filing a self-represented petition for divorce in the Shelby County Circuit or Chancery Courts.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a trained attorney who staffs that clinic, who, for a very low intake fee, can help that person effectively represent mm-hmm. him or herself in court. And that's a way to increase access to the courts,
right,
by empowering people to do it themselves more effectively. In our immigration program, we have a couple of positions at the Community Legal Center that are representatives accredited by the Department of Justice. They are not attorneys, but they can do much of what attorneys can mm-hmm. do before U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And they are able to free up our attorneys' time to do more court work, and able to offer their services at often a lower fee.
Mm-hmm.
So that is another way that we are leveraging our staff so more people can access relief through the courts. So I think that in my time at the Community Legal Center, it's made me reflect on, you know, how overwhelming the need is, and how we can think more flexibly and creatively about how to help the most folks possible.
Yeah. So for the folks in Shelby County or surrounding counties who are learning about the work of the Community Legal Center and who may say, wow, this is an organization that I really want to get engaged with, do you have opportunities for people to volunteer?
We do. We have opportunities for both lawyers mm-hmm. and non-lawyers. So if you are a lawyer and you are interested in donating your services pro bono to the folks at the Community Legal Center serves, we have opportunities available primarily in the areas of family law, divorces,
mm-hmm.
As well as probate, guardianships, what I used to do when I was yep. in private practice, serving as a guardian ad litem. So you can get in touch with us. You can go on our website. There's a volunteer form that you can indicate your interest, or you can give us a call at our main line. If you're a non-lawyer and you still want to help out, you know, some volunteer opportunities are a bit restricted because, you know, we are a law firm and we do have to ensure client confidentiality.
Right, right.
But there are often opportunities for help in the office, helping us get organized, helping mm-hmm. us answer phones, helping us assemble packets for upcoming asylum interviews. Mm-hmm. As we're getting back out there more in the community in these post-COVID times, hopefully more opportunities to help us with those community outreach events as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there are opportunities for lawyers and non-lawyers, and we would encourage those who are interested in getting involved in person to get in touch with us and see what their skills are and see what we might have a need in, because it's always changing. If folks are interested in supporting us financially as mm-hmm. well, they can make a donation on our website at www.clcmemphis.org. And those donations are so helpful to us because although we do charge low sliding mm-hmm. scale fees and receive grants to support our work, we are not eligible for some of the largest sources of federal funding for legal aid simply because we help folks that are above 125%
right.
of the federal poverty level. So mm-hmm. individual donations as well as company donations, those really enable us just to do the work that we do and to help as many people as possible.
That's great. You know, oftentimes when someone is seeking legal assistance, it's because they're going through a really difficult time in their life. You know, either a relationship hasn't panned out the way they thought, personal relationship or business relationship, or someone has died, or they've been the victim of a crime. So a lot of times when they come in the door, right, the presenting issue is a crisis or is a really tough one. So I wonder, Diana, in the midst of all of that really important work that you all are doing, what gives you a sense of hope? How are you able to continue to be positive about sort of the state of affairs in the world, given that your daily job involves working with people who find themselves in really challenging situations?
I think you're exactly right. When you are at a point where you need an attorney, you are often in one of the most stressful situations mm-hmm. of your life. And while lawyers are not therapists, they often do end up as counselors. You know, that's one of our job titles.
Mm-hmm.
To ease the burden of our clients. It's one thing that I used to tell my clients in private practice, I am here now, let me worry about this. And I see our staff doing that every day with folks who come in. So even though it is stressful, it can be stressful to see the overwhelming need and to be there for our clients. I love hearing about the outcomes that our attorneys get for our clients. It's amazing to me to hear the stories of clients who are overjoyed because they have finally been able to bring over a relative from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
They've finally been able to get a visa that will allow them to stay in the country without fear. They are ecstatic. They have finally been able to leave a non-functioning marriage,
mm-hmm.
get a divorce, and move on with their lives and do the things that they weren't able to do because they had been married for all of these
mm-hmm.
years. So hearing those stories, seeing the notes that clients write to our attorneys, and they're the superheroes here. Our staff is the one. Our staff are the people doing the hard work, and serving our clients day in and day out. I am there to support them and help guide the organization, but they are doing the really hard work. But I love hearing about when a client has come in or sent a note, or once a client sent the biggest bouquet of red roses to one of our attorneys, just in gratitude
mm-hmm.
for the relief that our attorney had gotten
mm-hmm.
her. Those are the things, those are the stories that keep me going.
Yeah. Well, Diana, thank you so much, you and all of the folks at the Community Legal Center, for the really important work that you do. And we hope that some of our listeners will be inspired to reach out and find ways that they can be connected with your organization.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been lovely.
So another wonderful conversation with a person really engaged in helping to serve folks in Shelby County and beyond. So we are going to be starting a new series next week. As those of you who are regular listeners of the show know, in 2022, we have done a number of series of shows on a particular theme so that we can go deeper than just a one-off conversation. Most recently, we did a series of shows on the structure or organization or governance of the Episcopal Church, which might sound like a little academic and perhaps even boring, but we had two big events this summer. We had the General Convention, which is the Episcopal Church in the United States and a few other countries, our governing legislative body that generally meets once every 3 years. We met this past summer in Baltimore. So we had a couple of conversations with Episcopalians very involved in high levels of governance to talk about their work and their understanding of how our church is structured. And then I have just returned from the Lambeth Conference, which is an amazing 2-week conference that generally takes place once every 10 years for bishops from throughout the Anglican Communion. The last one was held 14 years ago, and this is my first week back in the office after being with probably 1,100 bishops and spouses from all throughout the world to listen to their stories about how ministry is done in their own contexts. And the central overriding theme established by the Archbishop of Canterbury was God's church in God's world, and the focus was on creation care. How do we care for this planet Earth that we are called to be good stewards of so that there is a safe planet with clean water and clean air and not so much of the temperature and weather extremes for the future generation? And so I am working with our minister or director of communications, Emily Austin, to figure out how best to share my reflections about that experience with the diocesan family and beyond. But the next theme of our Faithfully Memphis show is a series called Behold It Unveiled, exploring the intersection of creativity and spirituality. And so our hope with this upcoming series, which begins next Thursday, is to be in conversation with artistic persons from all of the various ways in which you can express your creativity, whether that is drawing, painting, sculpture, in terms of the visual arts, whether it is singing or music, poetry. How do we, through our artistic creativity, connect with our Creator, with our higher power? And so next week, Emily Austin will be interviewing Clarence Davis, who is a local artist doing a commissioned piece for the Diocese of West Tennessee. And you'll have a chance to learn about his own faith journey and the sorts of things that inspire him to create beautiful, colorful paintings that are just a joy to behold. So we thank you for listening to Faithfully Memphis. Just a reminder that you can listen to this podcast wherever you hear other podcasts, including Spotify and Apple Music. We want to encourage you not only to listen, but also to follow us, to like us, and to give us comments and suggestions about things that you would like to hear in upcoming shows. So until next Thursday, stay safe and stay positive.